This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program this afternoon, we're going to talk with historian Matthew Sutton about the powerful, pioneering Pentecostal evangelist Amy Semple McPherson. Sutton says McPherson combined old-time faith, showmanship, and marketing savvy with technology, patriotism, and social conservatism. Sutton says the tensions and controversies that characterized her world are reflected in the faith and politics of our day. McPherson was born in 1890 to James and Mildred Kennedy in Ontario, Canada. Religion was important in the Kennedy household. Mildred, or Minnie as she was called, worked for the Salvation Army. As a girl, Amy preached to her dolls, but her true calling came as a young woman when she met and married her first husband, Robert Semple. McPherson's powers as an evangelist began to take shape during the First World War when she crossed the country in a car painted with the slogan, "Where will you spend eternity?" In 1923, she opened her megachurch, the Angelus Temple in Los Angeles. And then she began a megachurch of the airwaves, building a radio station so as to reach millions with her sermons. She was the first woman in history to preach over the radio. We'll hear a good deal more about Sister Amy in this portion of the program from our guest, Matthew Sutton, an assistant professor of history at Oakland University. He is the author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America. Sutton argues in the book that McPherson resurrected Christian America by reshaping and redefining old-time religion. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Matthew Avery Sutton's book, Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America, is published by Harvard University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Matthew Sutton, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. What was it about Amy Semple McPherson's preaching that drew so many people to her?
You know, it's a question that I've really wrestled with. I think it was a combination of things. Part of it was she had a natural ability to put on a good show. When she was a teenager, she had hoped to have a career as an actress. And so once she has this conversion experience that you mentioned earlier, she then funnels her energy and funnels her talent into preaching. She also had a good sense or a good ability to read a crowd, that whenever she was preaching before people, if they started to get bored, if they started to lose interest, she would change the tempo, she would change speeds, she would introduce some kind of a prop. And she was just very aware of her context, of her surroundings, and she was able to really mold her message to whatever crowd she was speaking to.
Yeah, so she was able to bring the gospel to life.
She really did, and she enacted it through her old life, through stories, through drama. She actually created elaborate productions in her church. I mean, she did whatever tools she could find to help her preach the old-time gospel. She was willing to just grab, to use without even hesitating.
Yeah. You quote her as saying, if Christ were alive today, I think he'd preach modern parables about oil wells and airplanes, the things that you and I understand, things like being arrested for speeding.
Right. That was one of her most famous sermons. She would use her real-life events, and part of this was her mastery at publicity, but she would use her real-life events to craft her messages. So one afternoon in the mid-1920s, she and her daughter and her mother were heading down to the beach in California for some rest and relaxation, and she got a speeding ticket. And she was only going about 7 or 8 miles over the speed limit, but this quote-unquote arrest still made the newspapers, and you know, it was sort of an embarrassing thing, and everybody was laughing about the famous evangelist who got a speeding ticket. So the next Sunday, people who showed up at church to hear her preach realized that the church set had actually been decorated like a highway and that there was a fork in the road, and she would ultimately admonish the congregation to decide which road they would take, Jesus's or Satan's. And she preached this sermon in a police officer's uniform. She was wearing an officer's skirt, a hat, and she had a motorcycle on the church stage, and she would actually flip the siren and let it just blare. And I'm sure that the sound must have been incredible because of the echo in this building. So she would use props. She would use everyday events like that to try to market her message to the masses.
Yeah. There's a photograph of her in that get-up in the book, which is really something.
Yeah. That's one of the famous sermons, and she had a number of others like that. She was in an airplane which crashed on takeoff, and she turned that into a sermon. She would, you know, do sermons based on different events in pop culture. When Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs came out by Disney in the 1940s, she did a sermon on Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. When Roosevelt preached his famous Four Freedoms, he didn't preach, when he delivered his Four Freedoms message, she did a sermon on the Four Freedoms. So she was quick to connect what she believed was a very traditional gospel with whatever was happening, whatever was current, what was going on in that day and age.
Yeah. Didn't she preach a sermon from an airplane?
I don't know if she actually preached one from it. There were a couple times when flying was such a novelty in the early 20s that whenever she would go anywhere, crowds would show up at the airports to see her off. And so she would sit in the airplane and she would always give a little message, I guess a little sermonette to them. The other way she used planes was when she would fly over the big cities, and these were, you know, open planes, these, you know, two-seat biplanes. She would drop copies of her messages over the cities, hoping that they would, you know, come floating down to just anxious sinners as well as curiosity seekers who would then know that she was holding a revival in, for example, San Diego or San Francisco.
She was so media savvy.
She really was. She was one of the first evangelists to come of age in this, you know, mass media world that was made possible both by film and by radio. And so right as soon as she settled in Los Angeles, she hired a publicity agent and she hired PR people who helped her, you know, build bridges into the larger national audience by exploiting really new technology.
Later in the program, I'd like to play a clip of Amy's daughter and Amy on the subject of Amy's pioneering work as a radio evangelist, Amy's daughter being Roberta. But here I'd like to play an audio clip from Anthony Quinn, where he describes the showmanship of Sister Amy. And I don't know if you are familiar with this clip, but I know Anthony Quinn does appear in your book. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. He actually joined the church as a teenager. His grandmother had gotten involved in Amy's church, and so he began playing in one of the church bands. The church had a lot of different sorts of social outreaches, and using bands to attract teenagers was one of them. And Amy apparently was able to identify his talent at a very young age. When he was 13 or 14 years old, apparently she probably sensed that he was destined for a public life, because she would go into the Mexican communities in Los Angeles and preach, and she was always looking for good translators. And so she recruited Quinn, who was a Mexican-American who spoke, you know, fluent Spanish. She recruited him to go with her into the barrio, and so he would actually translate her sermons. And so they developed a friendship at that point. And it's certainly something that stuck with him through the rest of his life, as I'm sure this clip will reveal.
Okay, here we go. This is Anthony Quinn describing the showmanship of Amy Semple McPherson.
There was something mystical about her. I mean, and I don't like to use that word. She could hold a pause. She would come out on the stage, and the lights would go down, and she would wear a pink or diaphanous gown, and then she would stand there and just look at the audience, hold the audience's attention, and I must say, I learned that from her. And then she'd lift up her arms slowly, and that gown would look like a bird, a beautiful bird, and she'd keep spreading the gown out, and still not say a word, just smiling at the audience. And it was hypnotic. It was absolutely hypnotic. Then she'd start very softly. She would tell you about what she was feeling at the moment. She was one of the greatest actresses in the world. Actors and people in the motion picture industry used to go and see her because she was phenomenal, phenomenal.
Anthony Quinn. She must have really been something.
Yeah, that's really a wonderful clip. I've read a number of things he wrote, but I haven't actually heard that particular clip, and that really captures her essence in a way, you know, much better than any historian could do, I think. That he really experienced that, and that was her ability, was to just go out there on the stage and speak in a way that nobody had done before, and, you know, possibly nobody has done since, and really, really make her message come to life.
Yeah. That clip, by the way, comes from a piece that aired some time back on All Things Considered on National Public Radio. It was produced by Deborah George, Art Silverman, and the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, part of the series Lost and Found Sound. And it's my hope to get a link to the whole piece that they produced on our website so that listeners can go there and hear the whole thing. But anyway, it's a very interesting clip. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Matthew Avery Sutton, author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Eureka on line four. Hi.
Hi. May I ask two questions, please?
Yes, you may.
First of all, maybe your work was associated with it, I'm not certain, but was the documentary in the American Experience series on Amy Semple McPherson accurate, according if you have seen it or know anything about it?
Yeah, it was actually based on my book, and I was the primary historical consultant.
Okay.
So I definitely would promote the documentary.
I found it extremely interesting. Extremely interesting. Secondly, I guess this would be bordering on scandal mongering, but the supposed scandal that I guess kind of did her in your opinion, and I can't remember exactly how the documentary handled it, but was that pretty much true that was reported about it?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. We sort of dodged the what really happened in the documentary, which I also do in my book, which I think has frustrated some readers. We don't know for sure what happened. Amy Semple McPherson disappeared in the spring of 1926. Her followers believe that she had drowned. That was the first explanation. She reappeared over a month later, and immediately rumors began to spread that she reappeared and claimed to have been kidnapped about a month and a half later, and then rumors immediately began to spread that she had been having an affair with her radio engineer, that he had disappeared at about the same time. So this then played out in all of the national newspapers and the national magazines and got the district attorney involved, who charged her with corrupting public morals and a number of other things. And so this just became the big story of 1926. Mm-hmm. In terms of what really happened, I think the most likely explanation is she probably did disappear with her radio engineer. This was a point in her life in which she was very lonely. She was very frustrated with being in the spotlight. It made sense that she would want to escape. But at the same time, the district attorney and the newspapers invested literally hundreds of thousands of dollars investigating the story, trying to prove that she had had a sexual affair, and they could never, ever, ever find any direct evidence linking her to the man she supposedly had the affair with. And so for that reason, I tend to give her the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, certainly an affair is the most likely, most reasonable explanation, but we just can't know for sure.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. How did she reconcile her embrace of theatricality with her disdain for the values of Hollywood?
That was an interesting thing for her. For the most part, she just denied it and probably hoped that the contradiction would go away, that she claimed what she was doing was, you know, faithful to the old-time gospel, and certainly there's a long tradition of American evangelists who embrace theatricality, people like George Whitefield and Charles Finney and Dwight Moody before her. But at the same time, she was very self-conscious and very explicit about the fact that she's competing with the latest trends in society, with the bowling alleys, with the movies, you know, with jazz music. And so she wanted to make sure that the message was the same, that it was the traditional gospel message, but that the methods of presenting it were up to date. And so for that reason, she would then justify taking a jazz tune and changing the words to give it a gospel meaning. And so it was sort of a bit of an ambivalence, that on the one hand, she tried to repudiate the stage in Hollywood, but on the other hand, she embraced some of its techniques, some of its tricks.
Yeah. In the book, you quote her as saying, the recipe for rabbit stew is to catch the rabbit. You know, first you got to get that audience.
Exactly. That she, yeah. For her, the goal was to get as many people as possible into her church. She wasn't trying to establish a church that had a regular membership where you have the same people Sunday in, Sunday out. She was trying to attract tourists to attract a large migrant population that's moving through Los Angeles in the 1920s. And so her goal was to create a spectacle, to create something that will draw people. And she succeeded. She really created the best show in town.
Yeah. Speaking of drawing people, you say attracting people of all racial, ethnic, and national backgrounds to the church without stoking the prejudices of her white followers was a problem that McPherson never adequately resolved. What stood in the way of resolving that program? A moment or two ago, he talked about Anthony Quinn and her using him as an aid to reach out to Mexican-Americans.
Yeah, certainly. I think it was her own human frailties, just like with every other leader, that she had this idealistic vision of creating a church that welcomed all classes and all races. And so we see elements of that with Anthony Quinn. At other times, she's preaching with African Americans. At other times, she's defending, you know, the rights of immigrants in California. But there are times in her life when she tends to get herself into trouble, the kidnapping scandal being one of them. And it's at those times then she tends to play on widespread racial and religious prejudices. So we'll see her embracing African Americans in the 19-teens and again in the 1930s. But in the 1920s, at the peak of her fame, where she's really trying to reach the Hollywood elite and the Los Angeles business community, at that point she's encouraging African Americans and Mexicans to go to their own churches, to their own Foursquare churches, but not attend her church. And she also appeals to the Ku Klux Klan, one of the most controversial parts of her life, that she seems to repudiate some of the Klan's values, but at other times she seems to line up along with the Klan. And so they show up at her services, they support her, they give money to the church. And so there's this sort of weird relationship with the Klan as well.
Did she ever speak or write of those contradictions?
For the most part, she didn't. And some of those are things that you know, my book brings out that other historians have not seen. The obvious stuff is, you know, the Anthony Quinn sorts of things in her work with some African Americans. It was more difficult to get at the racial prejudices, to sort of read between the lines and realize that the rhetoric she was using was the same rhetoric the Klan would use. And then I found some newspaper articles that nobody had seen apparently before, that, you know, where the Klan actually showed up at her church one day, and it wasn't McPherson, but one of her colleagues was burning three crosses up on the church stage. So real blatant racial moves. And those have just been overlooked by other historians, and part of that is because McPherson knew the right thing to do was to be racially inclusive, and so her own records don't leave us any sense of this ambiguity, but it's only by looking at the other materials that we get a sense of the contradictions.
It was also interesting to me to see how she built alliances. She worked with a number of Protestant denominations, and she also said that Roman Catholics were contributors to the Foursquare gospel movement. How did she build these alliances? How solid were they?
Well, the biggest thing to understand about her is she's an opportunist, that she'll build alliance, and this is, you know, the same thing with the topic earlier, the technology, that she'll use whatever means are available to her. And so building alliances was an important way to legitimize her own work, especially as a woman and as a divorced woman. She needed to find ways to substantiate what she was doing and to legitimize it to the larger community. And so at different times in her life, she's working with Presbyterians, with Baptists, Methodists, with Catholics. Even when she gets into politics in the second half of her life, she begins working with Jews as well. And so there's this contradiction that on the one hand, she's trying to get Catholics and Jews to become born-again evangelical Christians, but at the same time, she's willing to work with them on things they have in common, ideas like prohibition or fighting communism to find common ground. In this sense, she's very similar to the modern religious right, that, you know, people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson very much believe in heaven and hell for evangelical Christians, but they're willing to build broader alliances for political ends.
She preached what she called the Foursquare Gospel. What are the elements of Foursquare Gospel?
This was a simplification of the gospel that had been around for a while, and so she was drawing on older traditions, but it emphasized four aspects of Christ's character. He was Savior, he was healer, and she emphasized physical healing, the idea that you could pray for somebody and they could be physically healed. She emphasized Christ as baptizer in the Holy Spirit, which is one of the distinguishing elements of Pentecostals. They believe that after you were saved, after you converted, you had the secondary experience called the baptism of the Holy Spirit, which was usually signified by the ability to speak in tongues. And then the fourth aspect of the fourfold gospel was Christ as coming king. She believed that Armageddon was imminent, that the apocalypse was imminent, and that everybody needed to be prepared because Jesus was coming back for his church at any moment.
When she was a young woman, she had a crisis in her faith. It came when she was exposed in school to the theory of evolution. What happened?
Right. She had been raised, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, in a very religious household, very strict parents. But by high school, she was beginning to question the traditional faith for a lot of different reasons. She wanted to be an actress. She wanted to go to movies. She wanted to read novels. And these were all things that her mom's Salvation Army, very strict moral world, looked down on. And so all these raised issues for her. But then the biggest thing was in a high school geography class, she was exposed to the theory of evolution. And she began to think that if the Earth was not created, you know, in six 24-hour literal days and was, in fact, much, much older than the biblical account seems to indicate, then she wondered why you could trust the legitimacy of any of the rest of the Bible. How could you know that Jesus really came and died and resurrected? And so this created this crisis of faith where she began to question everything she believed.
Yeah. And then to the rescue comes Robert Semple.
Yeah, and then she decided to go to this Pentecostal revival. Pentecostalism was a new movement at the time, and these were the people who believed in very ecstatic worship. They spoke in tongues, they rolled on the floor, they had these very emotional, full-body worship experiences. And so she had heard about them. She had heard these rumors, and so she decided to go just to see the show, just to sort of sit in the back and scoff. But there she was enamored by the minister, by the revivalist, a guy named Robert Semple, a good-looking, tall Irish immigrant. And so it was her experience there that brought her both to Pentecostalism and introduced her to the man who would become her first husband.
Yeah. How did she talk about her calling?
That was something that was very important to her. She believed that God had chosen her to be a minister, that she had not chosen this of her own. And that's something, again, that's consistent with female religious leaders in American history, that to go against traditional gender norms so dramatically and so, you know, so boldly, it was careful to make sure you could justify it, you could explain it. And so instead of saying, well, I did this because I feel like I'm the most gifted person or because the other ministers just aren't doing their duty, she would say, I had no choice, that God insisted that I do this. And so for her, it always came back to this powerful prodding by the Holy Spirit calling her to be a minister to go and preach the word.
Yeah. Now, before Robert died, did she and Robert preach together?
They did. They served in Chicago, and they traveled around a little bit in Canada and in North America and the Midwest. And then they decided to go to China as missionaries in 1910, and that was a very pivotal event in her life. They were only there for a few months when Robert contracted malaria and actually died. And Amy was pregnant at the time with Roberta, her daughter. And so this left Amy devastated, alone on the other side of the globe. And so she had to figure out a way to get enough money to work her way back to the United States, which was a challenge.
Yeah. And now tell us about Harold McPherson.
Sure. So she gets back to the U.S. and decides that she needs a husband for herself and a father for Roberta. And along came Harold McPherson, a middle-class businessman who was very attentive to her, who was very interested. And so she ends up marrying him and having a second child, a son named Rolf. And for a couple of years, she lived a traditional middle-class life. She just played the role of wife and mother. But that's where she began to have failing health problems, and she began to feel that God was calling her back into the ministry. And so ultimately, she decides to leave Harold, and she invites him to come and walk with her. She says she's tried to walk his way and failed. And he responded by telling her to come back home, to act like other women, to wash the dishes and take care of the laundry. But, of course, she never again would embrace traditional female roles.
Yeah. In so many of the things she did in her life, she was a modern woman, a pioneer. Yet she leaves this husband to go out into the world, abandoning the gender norms of the day. Did she see fundamentalism at all at odds with that?
She did. And she generally tried, one of the things that made her so popular was she generally tried to emphasize what she believed in, not what she was against. And so she was very well aware that other fundamentalists were criticizing her as a woman minister and as somebody who was divorced. And so occasionally she would address those things explicitly, but more often it was indirect, that she would spend a lot of time justifying women's roles as preachers rather than specifically addressing the critiques of fundamentalist men. So, for instance, she would take the story of Adam and Eve and spin it on its head and say that the story of Adam and Eve is not about women's inferiority, it's about women's superiority, that woman was duped by an angel of light, Satan masquerading as an angel of light, while Adam was duped by a woman. And so she would argue that, in fact, women have been the greatest protectors of the gospel throughout history and through biblical times, and that they really deserve equal roles with men in leadership.
Mm. I wonder if someone like Phyllis Schlafly sees in Amy Semple McPherson something of a role model.
I see a lot of connections between the two. I'm not sure that Schlafly or other powerful female leaders today would, especially because of the scandalous side of McPherson, yeah. Because of the kidnapping and some of the other problems. Most modern-day evangelists or political activists try to distance themselves from her. But I think they have a lot in common, certainly.
Yeah. How has she influenced today's evangelists, for better or for worse?
I think, you know, she, in many ways, was building on an older tradition, but what she did that was unique was take ideas of theatricality and of mass media and apply them in an age in which things were changing rapidly. She made celebrity evangelism possible. That, you know, she was the first modern evangelist whose face was on the newsreels, who was in the headlines in, you know, national papers, who was on the radio. And she was also somebody who created these dramatic sermons, things like Arrested for Speeding, which brought a new flavor, a new sensibility into the church. And so modern megachurches in many ways do exactly the same thing. They're very quick to embrace technology, whether it's the internet or film or satellite television, you know, a few mm-hmm. decades ago. They also, you know, many of the biggest churches use drama in their sermons. They'll often have people in the church perform parts of the message, or they'll at least begin their sermons with that. And I think she was somebody who really set precedents for a lot of things that evangelicals do today, although, again, they often don't themselves, modern evangelicals don't claim Amy because of the problems with her legacy.
Yeah. Well, another evangelical couple that comes to mind is Tammy Faye and Jim Baker and their amusement park ministry.
Yeah, and I think she has even more in common with Tammy Faye than with Phyllis Schlafly. And one of the things that has distinguished Tammy Faye in, you know, the last decade or so is what a compassionate person she is. That for Tammy Faye, she's committed to the traditional Pentecostal message, but she's very quick to embrace outsiders, homosexuals, people with AIDS, groups that the traditional Pentecostal community have not been so welcoming of. And I think in many ways McPherson was the same way. That for her it was, you know, Mexicans during the Depression, or it was, you know, poor, impoverished women. But McPherson, like Tammy Faye, really seemed to have a heart for the outcast, for the outsiders.
How was McPherson seen, a young woman, now she's left her husband, Harold, and she's traveling across country with her mother and her two children, daughter Roberta and son Rolf, in the gospel car?
Right. Yeah, people were amazed by this thing. A lot of folks came to her revivals to just see this woman who would actually be doing something that, you know, this is also early in the age of the automobile, and so for her to be traveling without a man was another bit of controversy that followed her. But she, in those early years during World War I, she mostly worked among the poor, and she mostly worked among the Pentecostal communities. And so those folks tended to be less judgmental. They were the ones who were willing to welcome a co-laborer, somebody who was just like them, who maybe their life wasn't perfect. They weren't, you know, moving up the socioeconomic scale. And so they just came to see her and to support her, and they believed that the Holy Spirit was doing this work through her. And so they were willing to embrace her. It's only when she moves to Los Angeles and begins working among the more elite and middle-class audiences that she gets herself into trouble and that some of these issues are really raised.
Yeah. She and her mother, Minnie, were very close, and apparently the children, this is a pretty tight group. Minnie had, you know, worked with the Salvation Army. How did Minnie view her daughter's preaching?
Minnie was one of her daughter's greatest fans, and certainly Minnie tells the story of believing that even before Amy was born, that like the Old Testament heroes who give their children up to God to be prophets or kings or teachers, that Minnie claims that she knew she was going to have a daughter and that she was giving this daughter to God to dedicate the daughter to God's service. Obviously, it's, you know, we don't have Minnie saying that before Amy was born, so who knows if she was really saying that, or if just looking back, that's the sense she had of Amy's birth. But Minnie was extremely supportive of Amy as a minister, which was something she got from the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army really welcomed female ministers and female leaders. And at the same time, Minnie was a very adept administrator. And so Amy was the preacher. She was the charismatic one. She was the one who could draw the crowds. Minnie was the one who made sure the bills got paid and the auditoriums got rented and everything flowed smoothly. And so she was a nice compliment to Amy.
Yeah, and if something was going wrong, she let her daughter know.
Yeah, Minnie was also very domineering, very controlling, and part of this was probably about Minnie's personality. Part of it was also Amy's personality, that Amy was very immature. And so she really needed her mother there to keep her in check. And when her mother eventually leaves, when the two have a falling out in 1927, Amy gets herself into all kinds of financial trouble and religious trouble because she begins to, she's really taken advantage of. A bunch of people begin to prey on her innocence and her vulnerability.
Yeah, it must have been a tremendous burden. On the one hand, it's a tremendous accomplishment, but on the other hand, it's a tremendous burden to have this empire to manage.
It really was, that she was so lonely, and after leaving Harold, you know, she's trying to raise two kids, but she's also becoming a superstar. And this is in an era in which America's culture of celebrity is just being made. We're just beginning to see the Mary Pickfords, Charlie Chaplins, and the Babe Ruths, and the Charles Lindberghs. And nobody quite knows yet what it means to be a celebrity. Nobody really realizes mm-hmm. the kind of scrutiny your personal life is going to come under with the development of the tabloid press and, you know, really the Hollywood studio system. And so for McPherson, she's thrust into this world, and it's a very lonely place that she, you know, she wants to lead a normal life. At the same time, she wants to be a preacher, but it's almost impossible. She can't date. She isn't able to develop close friendships. Everything she does is closely watched both by her own allies as well as by her enemies.
Yeah. You mentioned Charlie Chaplin. The two of them knew one another. Tell us about that.
They did. Chaplin apparently came to see her on a couple of occasions, to come to see her preach. And then at one point in Amy's life, she was vacationing in France, and Chaplin happened to be there at the same time. And apparently the two met. Amy went and called on Chaplin, and they ended up sparking a wonderful friendship and spending a lot of time together, sort of debating what they had in common and what was different about their various crafts. And it seems to be one of these relationships that Amy had with folks who are very different from herself, but that showed her own sensibilities of what it was she was doing, that there wasn't that much different between her life and the life of somebody like Charlie Chaplin in terms of tactics and techniques, although Amy would always come back and say their goals were obviously very different.
Mm. So the family's in the gospel car, and they go cross-country, and they get to Los Angeles, and it's there they decide to settle. And she decides she wants to build a church. And modest is a relative term here. I think her first plan for the church was pretty ambitious, but then that plan, the dream, grew. Tell us about the temple that she built, and how did she manage to make it happen?
Sure. Well, she had been traveling from city to city to city trying to preach this fourfold gospel. And she decided, a couple things. She decided she was getting tired of life on the road, plus her kids were starting, you know, to get old enough that they really needed to be settled in one place and, you know, getting ready to go to school. And so ultimately she decided to go to Los Angeles, and this was the ideal place for her to be, and she knew it. And the reason was that this was the period of Los Angeles' tremendous growth. It would double in size between 1920 and 1930 to over 1 million people. Hollywood was settling there. This was really the first modern American city, the city that was post-automobile, post-telephone. And so it was the right place to be. And for her, she realized that if she built a church, then the masses would come to her, that she wouldn't have to go to them. And so she would draw these people to Los Angeles, they would be exposed to the four-square gospel, and then they would take that gospel back to wherever they had come from, back to the Midwest or to the Northeast or to the South. And that was at least her ideal. And so her first plan was to build a fairly small, and like you said, modest is a relative term, fairly small tabernacle. It was going to be wood. It was going to seat a couple thousand people. It wouldn't be a whole lot bigger than her revival tents, and it would be, you know, not terribly well built. But as her ambition grew, and as, you know, she also had to deal with city leaders who wanted to make sure this was a safe facility, she ends up settling on this plan to build this 5,300-seat giant church, which was shaped like a theater. It had mahogany opera chairs. It had a stage. It had two balconies. And it was this really enormous cement, state-of-the-art building. And to pay for it, she once again went on the road. She traveled from city to city to city raising money. And she would encourage people to be chairholders instead of being shareholders. And so for spending $25, you could have your own chair in Angelus Temple. And she was able to sell all 5,300 chairs this way at $25 a piece. And then, of course, she got other donations as well.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Matthew Avery Sutton. He's the author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon if you've got a question or a comment. We would like to hear from you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, fundraising, again, would have to come into the fore when she set out to build her radio station. And here maybe we could listen to that clip that I mentioned earlier of Amy's daughter Roberta and Amy on the subject of the radio evangelism. So why don't we play that clip now.
I was now 12 years old, 12 and a half. I had a little boyfriend. His name was Benny. The big fad in those days was homemade radios. So we worked out after school and we're making this little radio. The mother came in and she said, "What are you doing, kids?" I said, "We're making a radio." She said, "Let me hear." My mother heard that. She said, "Now I know what we're going to do."
What is my task? To get the gospel around the world in the shortest possible time to every man and woman and boy and girl. He said, "Well, sister, you won't make much headway into Beth, I'm afraid. That's kind of a closed country yet." "Well, I don't know. By God's grace, we're going to back a shortwave radio station right up against their borders and shoot her over. Amen. And get some men there to pick it up and amplify it. I never saw anyone of those people."
She suddenly realized that here there was a church without boundaries, a church without walls.
Pretty smart.
She really was. She had that first experience, as Roberta remembered, with an early radio that Roberta's boyfriend had been building. And then in the early 20s, she was preaching in San Francisco, and one of the first radio stations in the country had been set up. And so she was invited to come preach, and she just recognized what an amazing technology this was to reach far more people than she could ever reach in any particular, regular service. And so once she builds Angelus Temple, then she goes right to work with the next project, which was building a radio station. And sure enough, she raised the money, and in February of 1924, Call Foursquare Gospel, KFSG, went onto the air, and it was one of the most powerful radio stations in the West through the 1920s and 30s. Its signal could actually be picked up as far away as Australia on clear nights, and then to the Rocky Mountains, to the east, and up to Canada, and down to Mexico, so it really had a major influence.
Yeah. She was really a master of media. She had the magazine The Bridal Call, and she had apparently got some other publications, other printed materials distributed around the world. Phonograph records of her sermons were made, and apparently it was tough to keep up with that demand. And then she had the big church in Los Angeles and then the radio station. So
right, and then she would actually, in the early 30s, incorporate a film company. And her film projects ended up failing, but there was a lot of talk and there was a lot of excitement, a lot of buzz in Hollywood and the major fan magazines, the celebrity magazines, about Amy's project to create a film based on her own life, an autobiographical project. But she was actually not very good on film, despite all of her talent on the stage and on radio, and so that really was the beginning and the end of her movie career. But she also took out an experimental license for a television station, and she died in 1944, but certainly if she had lived longer, she would have been on TV as well. She just believed that the end justified the means, that as long as you got people to this point of having a conversion experience, you should use every media tool available. And she really believed with radio that Christians had an obligation to try to get in at the ground level so that they could use radio for their purposes rather than let it be taken by the secular world.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Charleston on line 4. Hi.
Yes, I've tuned in late. I don't know if you've already discussed the event of the movie Elmer Gantry. Now, I've recently rewatched that, and listening to your show, movies are what they are, but they seem to follow that business line along. Would that be an accurate assessment? I had heard about Amy Semple McPherson when I were a young boy from my parents, but did the movie follow her life in a factual sort of way?
Yeah, the movie based on the Sinclair Lewis's novel.
Right, yeah. It didn't follow her life in a factual sort of way. It did very much draw inspiration from her life in terms of her character in Sinclair Lewis's sort of jaded interpretation of Amy. Certainly for him, he sees her as a religious charlatan and a hypocrite. Others would take exception to that. But that's one of the things that's amazing about Amy is she's not only was a phenomenon in her own life, but she also has become a phenomenon in pop culture that in 1926, Upton Sinclair wrote a novel with Amy as a main character. In 27, Sinclair Lewis wrote Elmer Gantry. In 31, Frank Capra produced a film called The Miracle Woman, starring Barbara Stanwyck, based on her life. We have the Elmer Gantry film. Pete Seeger did a song in the 1960s called Amy McPherson. She just relives you know, and her story is told over and over again in you know, fiction and in film and in song, and to this day very much so. She just had this ability to capture the American imagination in a way that few other evangelists have done.
This one of Gantry's comments in the film was the radio thing began, and he called it, in the script anyway, the third ear. You know, that people could come and see and such at the tent and all that, but the radio thing was its third ear.
Yeah.
I thought that was fairly appropriate. Whether that came from Lewis or not, I don't know, but nevertheless, you know, it made sense to me.
Yeah.
But evangelism is what it is, you know. I mean, look at the what's out there now. You know, I mean, it's still with us, I mean, every day. And, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, why their influence is still pretty powerful. I don't know about Pat Robertson these days, you know, and his comments about Hugo Chavez. But anybody else would have been discredited, you know, pretty quick. But it was a great show. I enjoy it. Thank you.
Bye. Thanks for the call. We've got another listener waiting to talk with us in Danville on line one. Hi.
Yes. What happened to her ministry after she died? Well, she says it was all wrapped up around her after she died there at an early age. The temple, her ministry, or the radio, and she was going to go into television. What happened to her after she died? I don't hear much about that ministry anymore.
Yeah, it actually is quite successful. Her mother was a gifted administrator, and then when her mother left the organization, the reins eventually fell to her son to take care of the administration. And so when she died in 1944, her son Rolf took over the ministry. And by that time, it had spread to hundreds and hundreds of churches, four-square churches, and then it's continued to grow along with evangelicalism more generally throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. And so today they claim about 6 million adherents to the denomination, the International Church of the Four-Square Gospel. And some of the biggest mega churches in the country count for our four-square churches, and they're also very powerful in Latin America and Africa and places where Pentecostalism is just exploding. So the denomination is doing very well. Angelus Temple is still there in Los Angeles. It's a federal historic landmark, and it, too, is experiencing revival. They brought in a new young pastor in 2000 or 2001. And then the last thing, the radio station, the denomination controlled until the last couple of years, and they just sold it for, I believe it was over $200 million. So it was quite an investment for Amy. The $25,000 she invested in the 20s produced a radio station worth, you know, $200 million, or at least for the frequency.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have been a great fan of hers, and I wanted to ask two questions. One is, I haven't read the book, but know many who really admire her, and I was just having for lunch a Girl Scout cookie, which talked about confidence and character, and, oh, sorry. Anyway, she had these qualities.
Confidence and character? I think she very much did. Confidence is certainly something that she had a lot of, that, you know, to go out on stage in front of thousands and thousands of people and to get in front of the newsreels and all those sorts of things that she did required a lot of confidence. Character is a more difficult thing to define. She certainly, I think, had the best of intentions, although, again, like all people, she made mistakes, and there were times when she was self-serving and opportunistic and when she got herself into trouble.
And I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. We've got to wrap up here. Before we go, though, one caller here mentioned a couple of the evangelists of today, and it would seem to me that Amy McPherson's view of Christian America being under siege or being besieged is held by these evangelists today. You want to comment on that in terms of how we can wrap up here this afternoon and make a little bit of a larger statement?
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things about her legacy, is especially within her group in evangelicalism, within the Pentecostal community in particular. They had tended to focus on otherworldly issues, believing that, you know, heavenly salvation was what was most important, not earthly work or social reform or politics. And she really changed that, especially in the second half of her life in the 1930s and 1940s. She blended patriotism with faith, arguing that this had been a Christian country and that it was going the wrong direction, that America was in danger of secularization. And so things like prayer in the public schools, evolution, those became rallying points for her. And so she really convinced conservative Christians that they needed to make their voices heard and that they needed to do it in a nonpartisan way with as many religious advocates as they could. And so in many ways, she is a precursor to the modern religious right, that by encouraging Christians to take control of their country, to return it to its supposedly Christian roots, was a valid and legitimate goal they should be pursuing.
Mm. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Matthew Avery Sutton has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Amy Semple McPherson and the Resurrection of Christian America. The book is published by Harvard University Press. Matthew, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Celeste. I enjoyed this.